evening and welcome to Health Matters, the Mental Health Edition. I'm your host, Dr. Shelley Visconti, psychologist, licensed counselor, and marriage and family therapist. We are discussing substance abuse treatment this evening, and as our guests, we have Kit Gamble and also Catherine Price and Zena Hansel, all from Lincoln Nova Vital Recovery Center. Thank you all for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having us.
So first, I'd like to start with you, Kit. Let's talk a little bit about who you are and what you do. I know that you are the CEO and owner over at Nova Vital Recovery, but tell us a little more about you.
I've been in healthcare most of my life. We had Gamble Guest Care for years and sold it in 2015. And I've got about 45 years experience in healthcare administration. And I'm also a recovering alcoholic. And about 2.5 or 3 years ago, Dr. Randy Davis, my partner, and I decided we wanted to do something that we felt like there was a need for a good recovery center in North Louisiana. And we came together and started planning and ended up renovating a building that my brothers and I used to own, that we own now. For the recovery center. We both have children who suffer from the disease, and we wanted to help people to recover from the disease of addiction.
And Catherine Price, you are the clinical director. Tell us a little bit more about you.
Well, I am an LPC. I also have a master's in psychometric psychology. Since 2001, I began getting involved in the area of recovery about 11, 12 years ago. My husband and I are very active in recovery outside of the facility also. And I have, in the facility, I supervise the counselors, and we are working every day to improve the program to the fit the needs of our clients.
And Zena Hansel, tell us a little bit about you. You are the administrator. Tell us what else you do.
So I came to Lincoln Nova in April of this year. I moved back here from Colorado over the summer, last summer, and I've spent most of my life between Louisiana and Colorado, and I've worked the majority of my career in administrative director and management positions, and have a personal history, personal family issues as well, when it comes to folks who are in recovery and suffer from the disease. So I felt like it was a little bit serendipitous and almost like a God thing that he sent me over to Lincoln Nova.
Well, thank you all for being here this evening. I want to let our listeners know that this program was pre-recorded, so we won't be taking any calls this evening, but our guests have lots and lots of great information to talk about, and I'm sure that if listeners do have any questions, they can contact y'all. They can also look at your website. You've got a very helpful website.
Thank you.
That I checked out with lots of good information. Would one of y'all mind giving a number that they might be able to contact y'all at if they have additional questions?
Well, sir, by all means, please go to our website, and that is lincolnnova.com. And our telephone number, it's horrible that I always have to look it up.
And sorry, I didn't give you any notice that I was going to ask you that question.
That's okay. It's 318-224-4967.
So y'all have several different programs that y'all offer.
We do.
And so I wanted to start by talking about the Medical Addiction Detox Center. What is the Medical Addiction Detox Center?
So our detox center, we have a 16-bed hall, and folks who come in and are in need of medical-assisted detox due to the substances that they are currently on. Alcohol, we detox from alcohol, and there are special medications for each of those, and I'm not a medical professional, so I don't really want to go into exactly what all of those are and how they work, but if Dr. Davis were here, he would be more than happy to share all of that with you. But we do detox from alcohol. We also detox from opioids, and we detox from benzos, which are things like Xanax. Valium, things like that.
And so when might medical detox be needed?
So a lot of factors will come into that. They really have to be active in the use. So if someone is currently, we do urinalysis when they come in to get a gauge of what their levels are. And once we've determined that, that really determines whether or not our medical team will look and determine if medical detox is needed.
So perhaps somebody that has not used in several weeks, then that person might not necessarily require the medical detox.
Correct.
They might require one of your other levels of care.
Correct.
But it would need to be someone who is still actively using or recently used.
Correct. Yes.
And it's our goal with the medical detox to make people as comfortable as possible. It's very, very uncomfortable and even dangerous to try to detox on your own sometimes. And so we try to make people as comfortable as possible through this process.
Yeah, and I think some people may not realize that some of these drugs can be dangerous to detox on your own.
Absolutely.
So it is important that that you seek that medical attention for detoxing from some of these, not just for the support and not just for comfort, but also for safety.
Right.
Yeah, they go through a lot of different physical withdrawals. They have shakes and sweats and they don't sleep. They're very anxious and can be very agitated. There's tremors a lot. So the fact that we have nurses on staff 24/7 in the detox unit. We have a wonderful physician assistant, Lacey Culver. She's just amazing with our patients. And it's important that people do understand the need for that medical support when they are detoxing from these substances.
Yeah, it's not that, you know, that somebody's just not being tough.
That's right.
You know,
it's a lot more than that.
Extra medical care is really needed for safety reasons. Yeah.
And it's scary for them as well.
Yeah.
And Lacey's full-time. She's in the building Monday through Friday and on call. And then we have other physicians on call, so we really have a good backup staff in case somebody needs it.
So what does medical detox involve? If someone were to come to your medical detox center, what could they expect?
So it's what they can expect from detox is really that 20. We have one nurse that is specifically for our detox patients, and we don't like that ratio to go above 8. So our detox unit does hold 16 patients, and if we go above the number 8, then we bring in a second nurse on all shifts. We also do that with our substance abuse technicians, the techs, and again, that number on the detox unit is 1 to 8 as well. So they get round-the-clock care. They do, the techs are there with them all the time. The nurses are there all the time. If they are in a space where they can come out into the rest of the facility and go to groups, we encourage that. All of our counselors will go and meet each new patient within 24 hours of their arrival. So they're getting contact with as many people as they're comfortable with within that 3 to 7 day detox time.
So they're receiving the medical care, but also they're meeting with counselors.
Correct.
and getting also that mental health, that psychological care.
Yes.
How long does medical detox typically last? I know I'm sure it can vary a little bit.
It varies quite a bit. Medically, they can, and again, I'm not a medical professional, but it can range from 3 days to 7 days. And we have different protocols for different detox from detoxing from different medications. So. And again, if they have reached the end of that protocol and that patient still does not feel comfortable and doesn't feel okay, then our medical staff, like Lacey Culver and Dr. Davis, they will step in and reevaluate, and they can extend that for them. It's what the patient needs. That's what the focus is. So there may not be a specific time limit for anything.
So you're taking into consideration the specific substance that they're detoxing from, and then also just their particular medical needs and psychological
yes.
needs.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about inpatient drug rehabilitation. I'm sure that that is kind of your next kind of step after the detox. Would someone then go into the inpatient treatment?
Yes. Okay. Yes, they do. And we have a team of wonderful counselors, and Catherine leads that team. And we're lucky enough to have her on staff, and she has done a great job working with the counselors that we have. And I think that Catherine would be, you know, would be great to really talk more about what that inpatient program looks like.
Mm-hmm. So, Catherine, tell us about the inpatient program.
So with the inpatient program, when an individual comes in for treatment or transitions from detox to inpatient, they will meet with their counselor. Their counselor will, within the first 3 days, do an assessment and a treatment plan to get an idea of what goals need to be worked on during their stay. And they will attend groups. We have groups every morning, Monday through Thursday. And then Fridays are reserved for the counselors to meet with the clients individually. The clients can request individual sessions if they need. Our counselors work very closely to meet the needs. If the clients have concerns regarding legal, they can contact their POs, they can contact courts. We have had clients with family issues where the counselors have done family sessions over the phone. They work very close to make it very individualized treatment.
So it sounds like you're trying to meet their mental health needs, but also any psychosocial needs that they may have. So if they have some legal issues, if there are some family issues, that those also, you're making sure that those are attended to also.
Yes. We try to take an overall approach and talk about, you know, physical health, the importance of maintaining that, the importance of learning good communication skills, learning good coping skills, getting the solid foundation to begin recovery after treatment.
So they're doing group, they're doing individual, they may be doing some family sessions. How much time per day are they usually spending in counseling?
The counseling, small groups in the mornings, go from 9 to 11:45. They have 2 15-minute breaks. Then after lunch, they will have either what we call a fears, cares, and concern group, or they will have a big book study, depending on the day. After that, they'll have a lecture, which we have a lecture session every day but Friday. And the counselors are individuals from the outside. We have gambling, we have smoking cessation lectures, anything that will benefit the client. And then they also have study hall time to complete assignments, homework assignments given by their counselors. And we also incorporate a 12-step meeting in the afternoons.
So they're spending a good bit of time in therapy, but it's addressing several different types of needs.
Right.
Yeah. So many hours in counseling and therapy, but you're doing some big book work. You're doing some just kind of self-care skills, and then also some processing and so forth.
Correct.
So what does, other than the counseling, what else does the inpatient treatment involve, and how long does it typically last?
Inpatient treatment usually lasts about 28 days. Some may get less, some may get more, but average is 28 days. We also have a gym for them to utilize because exercise can be very important, to get rid of some of the chemicals in the body that have accumulated, but also as a stress reliever, to get out some of that frustration, the physical exertion. We also have rec therapy. They may do arts and crafts. That may include basketball, something that is getting them back to learning how to relax, to spend time creatively. We don't want them to have a lot of time to just sit around, but we also don't want just a lot of busy work.
Sure. Sure. So you're really tackling, you know, the mind, the body, and then also any spiritual needs that the person may have.
Yes.
So the person may go into medical detox, or they may enter straight into the inpatient program. Is that correct?
That is correct. Okay. Yes.
And then if the person needs additional treatment, they can then do the outpatient drug rehabilitation program. Is that correct?
That is correct. Okay. Yes.
And so, when might outpatient treatment be appropriate? I mean, of course, after they complete the inpatient treatment, but would it be appropriate for somebody to go straight into outpatient treatment?
Yes. Yeah. We currently have, we're really lucky. We have two clinical directors. We do have Catherine Price. She's our, you know, our inpatient clinical director. And Mia McMahon is our outpatient clinical director. And so we do what's referred to as IOP, which is intensive outpatient. And that's a 12-week program. They meet 9 hours a week. Very similar to the schedule that Catherine talked about, where they have a 3-hour span with 15-minute breaks to discuss different topics. That program is structured just a little bit differently. They do focus on a lot of the same things with substance abuse, relating that back to the family. A term that's used quite a lot is that stinking thinking that gets us all in trouble. So it's to really help them stay in recovery, because sobriety happens inpatient and recovery happens outpatient.
And if someone, I know that inpatient, someone might would not be able to work because they're focusing solely on,
that's right,
on,
yeah,
their sobriety and their inpatient treatment. What about outpatient? Is that something that someone could work, or do y'all discourage that?
Oh, no, we encourage it. It's okay to keep that structure in their lives. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of folks, they have family members. They have families to support. So they do need to work. And our IOP program runs in the evenings. It starts at 6 o'clock at night, runs till 9, 3 days a week. And then on Tuesdays, they do an aftercare group. That's about an hour long. So we are really trying to incorporate those things so folks can get back to some normalcy and be productive and be, you know, good members of the community and keep their jobs. And that structure is just so very, very important.
Yeah. So when might outpatient treatment be appropriate and not necessarily inpatient, and vice versa? Is there a way that you all determine, well, this person really needs outpatient or this person really needs inpatient?
There's an assessment process for both.
So there would be an interview, an intake kind of interview,
correct,
and based on different information that you mm-hmm. glean from the interview, then there would be a recommendation as far as inpatient treatment or outpatient treatment.
You got it.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about co-occurring disorders? Y'all also treat not only the substance abuse disorders that people may present with, but then also you do address some of the co-occurring disorders. Would y'all mind talking about that a little bit?
Yeah. Catherine, would you mind going into that for them, please?
We have a lot of clients who come in who are also diagnosed with possibly anxiety, PTSD, major depression, or depression. A lot have bipolar disorder. We also get some with schizophrenia. Those are our most common diagnoses.
And so while they are in treatment, these other co-occurring disorders are also being addressed?
Correct. Okay. Our counselors incorporate diagnosis, education, symptoms, what they may experience when one of these mental illnesses, you know, is expressing itself. They educate on coping skills, and we do stress that just because a coping skill works for one individual, they may not work for all. So you have to find the coping skills that you're willing to use and that work for you.
We also have two psychiatrists on staff. One of them, Dr. Karen George, is a psychiatrist and an addictionologist, and the other psychiatrist is
Dr. Jody.
Dr. Jody, and so we have that available to help people with the co-occurring disorders.
And that's so important because often people are self-medicating some of these mental health issues, and so that mental health issue needs to be addressed also to really get at the root cause, or one of the root causes. Usually there's several root causes for substance abuse problems, but get at one of those root causes, which may be an attempt to treat themselves some of those symptoms of PTSD or depression or anxiety or schizophrenia, what have you.
I think that's really easy to understand and to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there are so many of us in the community in general that do suffer from some kind of personal issue. And I understand it's easy to want those thoughts to just stop.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I'll have patients, with post-traumatic stress disorder from time to time who are having difficulty sleeping, and they find that having a few drinks before they go to bed will help them to sleep, and then it's, well, maybe a few drinks will help me also relax when I'm feeling anxious during the day, and then before you know it, we've also got a substance abuse disorder that we also need to treat in addition to the post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes.
What are some of the most common addictions that you all see people seeking treatment for?
We get a lot of those who are addicted to meth and heroin. Those are probably the two we see the most combined with marijuana use. And the number of those seeking treatment, even for the synthetic marijuana, the Mojo, those are increasing also.
Yeah, and I think that some people don't understand that synthetic marijuana is not marijuana.
Right.
those are two totally different things.
Exactly.
And so some people get into it thinking that it's an alternative for marijuana, and it's really nothing like marijuana.
We see those diagnoses written so often, though. Yeah.
So what are, I know sometimes we'll talk about, we hear about opiate addiction in the news and so forth. What are opiates? What are opioids?
I think they're painkillers. That's probably the most common term used. Mm-hmm. You know, when you talk about Vicodin, Percocet, Narco, Oxycodone, Oxycontin, all of those, they're painkillers. And they take away the pain, and they continue to keep taking away the pain that you didn't even know was there because they feel so good from taking them.
Yeah. And these are medications that are sometimes legally prescribed, but still have an addiction potential.
Addiction potential. Yeah.
And so we have to be really careful with those medications because they do create a feeling of euphoria, and if there is a pain disorder going on, they will get rid of the pain, but unfortunately they also will also cause problems, especially when we may not be able to get those medications legally.
Correct.
And then we start trying to get them illegally, and the problem just snowballs.
Yeah, heroin used to be, you know, a blue-collar drug, and now it's become more and more often, it's become a white collar or a middle class drug because, you know, I think the government and its infinite wisdom, you know, they react to problems and they've made it a lot harder for physicians to prescribe opioids. So people are turning to, they get addicted and they turn to heroin and drugs like that where, you know, in years past, you never heard of anybody middle class, you know, getting addicted to heroin, and it's an awful problem, and it's a terrible thing. I don't know what the solution is other than all of us trying to help people who are addicted, but it's a problem that we really need as a nation to address.
Yeah, and you're right. We'll see people who started out on pain medications, and then when their prescription ran out, then they might be able to buy some from this person or that person illegally, and then that becomes difficult, and then they turn to heroin as a substitute for the pain medication, and so that is definitely an issue that we're seeing increasing is
heroin use in populations that we didn't used to see that use occur in. What is the difference between drug addiction and drug abuse?
A lot of times we will hear about somebody who maybe drinks alcohol a lot, but then they can quit. If they can have a couple of drinks and quit, they may not be an alcoholic. There's a difference in being a functional addict and a non-functional addict. You know, there are those who can smoke a few joints and then go to work and have a productive life. And there are others where smoking a few joints means then they're going to the alcohol, then they're looking for the meth. And it's that transition from one to another to where it becomes to the point they can't function. They can't do a daily routine. They can't have normal relationships.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about, is it interfering with a person's daily functioning, right?
Right.
You know, is it interfering with your work? Is it interfering with your relationships? Is it interfering financially? Is it interfering as far as, do you now have legal problems because of your substance use? If we start seeing that the substance use is interfering negatively with these different life areas, then we need to start looking at an addiction
right.
rather than just... I don't want to say just abuse, but rather than abuse.
Correct. Yeah, that's what I think. That's difficult for a lot of people to differentiate. And when they can't differentiate, that's when the problem really is there.
Yeah. And often, you know, we're in denial for a while.
Sure.
About, yes. You know, how much the substance use is impacting us.
Yeah. Oh, I can handle it. That's fine.
Yeah.
It's not a problem.
Sure.
Yeah, when we start lying to ourselves about how much we drink each night, we know we got a problem. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How does prescription drug abuse begin? Are there some signs that someone is abusing their prescription medications? Is there anything that we should be looking for?
It could be the money. Maybe the money's disappearing. Maybe they're becoming more agitated. Definitely if their prescription's running out faster than it should be. Anything that would indicate that's abnormal for that person. Maybe they're not sleeping. Maybe they're sleeping more. And that medication, maybe it's pain medication. They're hurting so much sooner than before. And just that need to have that medication constantly, that obsession with that medication.
So it sounds like a change in tolerance levels. Are they becoming more tolerant? Are you seeing changes in their functioning? Are you seeing changes in their personality, changes in their behavior, things like that?
Yes.
What are some of the risk factors for developing an addictive disorder?
It can vary. Of course, there's always a low socioeconomic status. There's also the abuse, childhood abuse, neglect. And sometimes it's just that feeling of irritability, restlessness, and discontent. And those substances, that person finds those substances, and it changes how they feel. And it works for a while. It becomes a coping strategy to help them feel like they belong.
So would something like anxiety or depression or post-traumatic stress disorder, would that be a risk factor for developing an addiction?
Yes, it definitely can be if they are attempting to self-medicate to feel better, of course, to change how they feel. It can be.
How have y'all... seen addiction affecting families, affecting not only the person themselves, but their spouses, their children, their parents. What impact have y'all seen?
It can affect in many ways. You know, even the family members becoming obsessed with the person who is abusing the substance, mm-hmm. To where they are trying to hold everything together. Maybe they start nagging. Maybe they start, you know, trying to make excuses for this individual. It definitely affects financially, emotionally, when the person is not there, when they say they're going to be there. The lying, the children, you know, the insecurity, the desire to be with the person that is no longer there. And it's hard to understand for somebody new to substance use that the addict is not making a conscious, rational decision to choose drugs over the family, over the children. Mm-hmm. That can be very difficult to understand. And so it can definitely affect those involved, their feeling of self-worth. Are they loved? Are they cared for?
Yeah, one of my supervisors, when I was training, said, you know, it becomes your primary relationship. It becomes more important than your children. It becomes more important than your work. It becomes more important than your spouse. It becomes your primary relationship, and it's really difficult to function in these other relationships if a substance is your primary relationship, your primary reason to get up every morning. It really impacts your ability to be able to have functional relationships, and you really just can't.
Yes, and that, I'm not going to do it again. Mm-hmm. I've quit. I'm done. I'm through. That can be very, very heartbreaking when that is said over and over. And the addict may mean it, but that addiction has taken control.
Yeah, and that's why it's so important to get good treatment so that you have those coping skills, you have that support, because it's addiction is a difficult thing.
Right.
It's really tough. And so getting that treatment, getting that support, making sure that you have accurate diagnoses and treatment for any co-occurring disorders is so important in ensuring continued sobriety.
Mm-hmm. Because the addiction doesn't go away.
Yeah.
Your ability to face it and to not succumb to the addiction, you know, that's what you hold on to. But that addiction's always there.
Sure. I mean, yeah. Someone may continue to experience cravings and so forth. And a desire to kind of go back to that old coping mechanism, that old substance.
Sure.
So it's something that we have to address daily.
Mm-hmm.
To maintain that sobriety.
Yeah.
I wanted to let our listeners know this evening we are talking about substance abuse treatment, and I have as my guests, I have Kit Gamble, Catherine Price, and Zena Hansel. They are from Lincoln Nova Vital Recovery. And again, we are talking about substance abuse treatment, and we are not taking any calls this evening. This program was pre-recorded, but you are welcome to get more information about substance abuse treatment from their website. And you can also contact them at Zena.
You can contact them at 318-224-4967, and you can also find us on the wonderful interweb, that is www.lincolnnova.com.
So are there things that family and friends can say or can do to help encourage someone to get help?
You can try, or you can get an interventionist, or you can call our staff and we'll try to help. But generally, until the person decides on their own that they want help and that they're sick of the condition they're in, it's a very hard thing to do. Making the decision to go into treatment's extremely hard. I went to treatment 3 times, and it was a very difficult decision. And probably the hardest thing to become sober is accepting the fact that you've got to change your life. And for me, I finally had to decide that I never wanted to take another drink again. And once I decided that and prayed to God to take the desire to drink away, then it worked. But prior to that, I kept thinking I was going to learn how to drink responsibly again, and it just didn't happen for me. One of the things after I got into AA, just it's kind of off the subject, but to add, is what surprised me was the number of people that die of this disease. I mean, you hear about people overdosing, and that's obvious, but lots of people, particularly alcoholics, die of all sorts of other problems, whether it be pancreatitis or liver disease or heart attacks. Those of us in AA, when one of our people who've been in and out of AA die of a heart attack, as an example, we know that it's probably as a result of their drinking. And it's really a difficult thing to when you think about the numbers of people that really die of the disease. And there's probably no way to keep really accurate statistics on this, but it's there, and it's a serious problem. And I think if people realized how many people suffer and die from the disease, they'd be shocked.
Yeah, and that's a good point to make, because not only are there co-occurring mental health disorders, but there are also co-occurring medical issues that come along with long-term or even sometimes short-term use of these substances.
Absolutely.
That can be fatal, but that can also cause strokes and other types of medical emergencies that can have a long-term effect on the person.
That's right. That's right. It's a serious problem in our society, mm-hmm. That's for sure.
And I think what you said about the, the person really has to decide that they want to get sober. And that decision, they may be really 100% into that decision, and relapse can happen. And so sometimes we do have to go back to treatment. That does occur sometimes, that someone can be very serious about treatment, and then something, there's some kind of roadblock or something, and then there's a relapse, and then we, have to go back to treatment to kind of get a booster shot.
It all depends on the individual. Mm-hmm. Some people can stop drinking on their own or go to AA and stop drinking. Some people stop drinking the first time they go to rehab. And others, it takes them four or five times to stop. But you never quit trying, because you may get it on that fourth mm-hmm. or fifth time. It's a weird disease, but there's always hope. You just have to help the person to keep trying and trying, and not judge them for going to rehab or doing whatever it takes for them to get sober.
And Catherine, I believe it was you that said, not every treatment is going to be effective for every person. And so, Kit, I think what you said, that some people, it's going to be effective that first time. And sometimes some other people, it's going to take a few times. And so it's not a one size fits all approach. It really has to be individualized, and no one should be ashamed because they had to take a different treatment approach than another person.
Yeah, that's right.
As long as it works, that's all that matters.
That's exactly right.
And that's one of the reasons, because I hear so often, well, I'm doing this for my kids. And I tell the clients, don't do this for your kids. It has to be for you. It's not going to stick if it's for somebody else. Kids can be great motivators, but we hope it never happens. But if that relapse does happen, what message do those children get? Mm-hmm. And if it's for the client, they're more willing to stick with it, even when they're upset with their kids, even when they're mad at mom and dad or whoever it may be. If they're doing it for them, that's where it's got to come from.
Mm-hmm. How can families participate in recovery?
There are a lot of ways they can get involved. They can ask questions. We do a family orientation for every person that comes to visit, and we try to educate on what treatment's about. We educate on what to look for, how to approach it. For instance, avoiding enabling, avoiding making excuses, but also avoiding nagging, avoiding making the client or the substance user feel bad for past mistakes. Because going to treatment is not a quick fix. Recovery is a lifelong process. And just like the substance user has to work on themselves, so does the family. The family may have to work on learning to forgive, not only the substance user, but themselves also. And letting the past be the past. It takes time to learn to trust. It takes time to learn how to build a healthy relationship again.
What are some of the reasons that someone might be reluctant to seek treatment?
I think the social stigma of it all is one. I think socioeconomic problems is another, because if a person's not eligible for Medicaid, then it's very expensive, and if they are eligible for Medicaid, they have to give up their income while they go to treatment, and it's a big step. It's a huge decision to make, and it's one we understand, but that doesn't make it any easier.
No, and I also think that there are stigmas attached to going into treatment and asking for help. We're not a society where therapy of any kind is really looked at as a good thing.
It's true.
As a necessary well-being thing. And I think, getting that to change is something that would be wonderful. And I think that ties in with folks going into rehab, because they do have a problem. They do need help. They can't do this on their own. And it's hard to ask for help.
And I think those are very big factors. And I also think that the fear of change, because change mm-hmm. requires getting uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And when you have self-medicated so long to not feel discomfort or to feel pain, and then all of a sudden it's all right there, all those emotions that have been kept pushed back, all that physical pain, all that irritability, restlessness, discontent, it's all coming to the surface now.
And it's scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, often I'll see fear of failure.
Yeah.
If I go in and I'm telling everybody I'm going to get sober, I'm going to get clean, and then I'm not able to, mm-hmm. what am I going to do?
Yeah.
It's a big one.
Mm-hmm. What about diet and exercise? Can they help in recovery?
Absolutely. I think they can. That's why we've got a very well-equipped gym so that people can learn to exercise, because, as you said, the alcohol has been their best friend in their life for so long that that they don't, have the time to work out. They're too busy drinking. And also, you can learn to handle stress through that by getting your endorphins going and things like that, and you don't have to worry about taking a medication to deal with stress sometimes. So
it tires them out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, exercise is great for mental health.
Absolutely.
It does really great things for mental health. And, of course, someone who's in treatment and recovery, making sure your mental health is tip-top is going to be really important. And just physically, that you're physically strong also is going to be really important. What about the spiritual aspect of recovery? Is that important? Is that part of treatment?
We, being a 12-step program, we do include a higher power, because we do talk about, our counselors talk about, if you're not in control, who is? Because if you can't control your use, you can't control your life, who is in control? So that does play an important part. And we do offer On Sundays, for instance, we do have people who come in and offer the spirituality group. That is an option.
What about adolescents? Do y'all treat adolescents, or are y'all just primarily adults?
Totally adults.
Okay.
18 and up.
Okay. So folks who are 18 and above.
Yes, by all means, please contact us if you have any questions about that. Mm-hmm. If you think that you may need treatment, you may have a problem, you know somebody who does, and you know you want help, please just reach out to us and we'll do our very best to help you, whether it be in our facility or someplace else, as long as you're reaching out for that help.
Mm-hmm. Support after treatment. I mean, that's really important. What type of support do y'all recommend after somebody's been through inpatient treatment and then maybe been through the intensive outpatient program? What would y'all recommend the next step be to maintaining that sobriety?
Well, first and foremost is AA. I know that the first two times that I went to treatment, I didn't think I needed AA. And I thought it was a waste of time. And then when I finally went through the third time and had made up my mind to change my life, AA helped me do it. AA, going to AA meetings just reminds you that you have a problem. And if you go to an AA group and you don't feel like you fit in, keep trying to find another group, because you will find a group of people that you have things in common with and fit into that. I think that's just vital. Of course, counseling and other things are important too, but AA to me is the biggest thing for aftercare.
And as you said, AA, I kind of look at it as Baskin Robbins. There are many flavors. If you try one flavor and you don't like it, just, you know, get another sample.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Because there are groups for younger people and for older people, and there are some that are more focused on the spiritual aspect. There are some that are more focused on other kind of special interests and needs. And so you really, you know, try several different groups, because if you do, there are lots of them out there. You will find one that feels like that's your AA family.
That's right. And AA is not a respecter of socioeconomic conditions. And, you know, there are people in AA meetings, you know, from homeless people all the way up to physicians. And groups are different according to socioeconomic conditions, so you can find the right group, and certainly regardless of what your background is, you can be prone to have an addiction problem.
What might we be able to tell someone who's afraid of going into inpatient treatment, who is afraid of taking that step to really get a handle on their substance abuse disorder? Any suggestions, any words of wisdom or any motivating suggestions or anything for that person that's kind of on the cusp there?
Well, I think that when your life has gotten to a point where you know you cannot manage it anymore, you've already reached rock bottom, you've already reached a place where you don't know what the answers are, and you're scared, you need help. Let us help you. If it's not us, please find someone who can help you, because this is something that you cannot do by yourself. You just can't.
Just do it. That would be my words.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Reach out to someone, anyone, but just reach out.
How often do people really stick with their recovery program, and how often do people drop out and maybe come back later? I mean, is it pretty common for people to drop out and come back later, or do people usually stick with it the first time around?
It's very common for relapse or for individuals to leave prior to graduation when they are in treatment. Just that fear, that discomfort, feeling like they need to take care of other business. maybe they haven't reached that point yet where they are done. But if they keep doing what they're doing, they're going to reach that point where they're done. The only other consequence is death, you know. And that's the sad nature of the disease of addiction. But it is very common for relapse to occur. But if you get that chance to try recovery again, take it.
Well, and often I'll have patients say, oh, well, I failed. You know, I relapsed and I failed. And, you know, I will talk to them about their recovery journey and that this is part of your journey. And it's not that you didn't learn anything. It's not that you didn't acquire any skills. There are things that you have learned. There are things that you have acquired as far as sobriety. And this is part of your journey. What are y'all's thoughts about that?
I mean, personally, I think that there's no failure. You make a mistake. You have one. You made a choice. Let's make a new one.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just re-choose sobriety. It's okay. That's why we're here.
So we have just a few minutes left. I'd like any parting suggestions or words of wisdom that you as the experts might have about substance abuse treatment and sobriety.
I think that what I would like people to understand is that substance abuse, whether it be a drug, whether it be alcohol, it affects so many people. And that it's the ripple effect. You know, if someone you love is addicted to alcohol or to drugs and you're afraid for them, reach out for help. Find someone. There's always someone willing to listen, whether it's your local church, whether it's AA online, whether it's Al-Anon online. And please understand that you can't change the person that's addicted. They have to change. And coming from a family where addiction was so prevalent, that was something that I struggled with a lot, was trying to understand, just like Catherine, just like you said earlier, that it's, why aren't they changing? Why is that more important than me? And it's not that it is more important. They are addicted. It is a horrible, horrible disease. So please reach out to someone. Someone will be there to help you. Just take that first step.
And I think treatment is so important to give the individual that time without the outside worldly distractions to focus on them for a change, mm-hmm. to learn who they are as an individual without all the labels, without the stigma of their past, but to learn what makes them happy, what brings them peace, who are they as an individual, and who do they want to be, and to learn to start taking steps to become the mother, the brother, father, sister, son, daughter that they want to be.
Kit, any parting words?
No, just, you know, realize that this is a lifelong mm-hmm. commitment. And after you finish going to rehab, go to AA.
Well, thank y'all so much for being with us. We had Kit Gamble and Catherine Price and Zena Hansel, all from the Lincoln Nova Vital Recovery Center, discussing substance abuse treatment. Thank you all for being with us this evening.
Thank
we really
so
appreciate
much.
It. Thanks. And Zena, why don't you give that information one more time?
All right. So please call us if you have any questions. Our phone number is 318-224-4967. You can also find us on the interweb at www.lincolnnova.com.
Thank y'all again so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Mental Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all mental health questions, consult a mental health professional. The views and opinions expressed on Mental Health Matters do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Red River Radio, LSUS, or its employees. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Mental Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, and production assistance has been provided this evening by Wally Derleth. I'm Dr. Shelley Visconti. Thank you for joining us this evening.